Mr. James, Reel 14. Right, Mr. James, in Thetford, before you move to Yarmouth, the battalion history talks about a couple of more exercises, Boxer and Princess Titty Sweet. Do either of those?
Yes, I can remember them very well, but especially Princess Titty Sweet. But we were getting more and more of these little exercises, and I was at those exercises. I was CQMS traveling in the cook's lorries. I mean, I've got very vague memories indeed of those exercises, but I do remember Boxer and I do remember the history, but I can't gather anything special to report about either of those.
So they merged into the routine, would be the same as the first exercise.
I mean, I had different duties from those. I began in those exercises to do CQMS.
Yeah. So what was the difference? Define what you were doing.
You see that I was now traveling in a 30-hundred-foot truck at the side of a bloke called MacDonald. He was my driver, Private MacDonald. I think he came from Manchester, but he was the permanent driver in the 30-hundred-foot, with the sort of canvas-covered bag, which contained all the cooking utensils for the company, the porridge pans and everything else, and all the equipment for field food. So I was traveling with him in comfort, in the front cab with him, having a nice ride in the cook's lorry, going from place to place and setting up where we could and where the troops had to have their meal at the end of the day. We were given instructions as to where, and don't know when again, would say B echelon would be for the battalion. And so each company and company cooks would set up hurriedly their row of burners, which were like small Bunsen burners, blowing out I think it was paraffin, blowing out the flames into this sort of long grid on which were the great big wonderful pans full of whatever, boiled potatoes or you name it. Then there was the stew. Usually it was stew because it was easy. And it just had a ladle of this sort of chunks of meat mixed with vegetables and whatnot. It was normally a sort of stew and plenty of it at the end of the day. And we never, of course, we had, I suppose, loads of bread in England, but I was going to say that wasn't normal because in action we did seem to every 6 months in it, but another story. But food, we would set up the kitchen anyway. We'd sometimes have as well. If we were visiting a place where there had been sort of pre-arranged military happenings, a row of washing up stacks, maybe fire underneath, boiling water, smoke coming out of the chimney stacks, and where people were sort of wash their place more. But that's out in the open. But normally, on stuff like that, we would have the cooks highly mobile with their rows, their grid of burners, one at each end, blowing in the heat and the steam on top simmering.
Did you ever have any problems in terms of, like, the food wouldn't be ready when the troops needed
No,
it, or did you ever have to, like,
no.
reprimand anybody?
We weren't reprimanded, but know exactly when the troops would be available for food. And he and the RKMS would issue instructions to where we had to be at a certain hour and when the cooks should have it gone ready for the troops. And we were never late, we were always early, as a matter of fact, well in advance, ready for them when they turned up for their estimates for food.
So Bert Newman was very efficient at his job.
He was, yes, he was. I must admit that in England, anyway, he was most concerned although he didn't do anything, he had his own quarrel. The cook sergeant and the CQMSs and the cooks would receive vital instructions from him regarding times.
Mm-hmm. In the battalion history, it talks about, I think in Princess Tilly's Raid, that it talks about Colour Sergeant Baxter and Sergeant Battle and Private Thaxter launching an attack with pots and pans at one point in this exercise. Did anything like that happen? I know
Corporal Thaxter. He was a corporal, but I don't know about that because I wasn't present at that, but yeah. I heard something about that.
It's just mentioned in the battalion history, they say that, yes, that the sergeants launched an attack with pots and pans.
Yeah.
If these exercises have all merged into one, in terms of your memories, are there any like specific incidents that maybe you can't attribute it to a particular exercise, but when you're out on them, when you're out on manoeuvres, out on schemes, any incidents that stick in your mind?
After Thetford, yes.
Yeah, well, not on this early days, because we're trying to talk about the early...
I can only recall one incident later.
Yeah, we'll talk about that later on. Then. So
right.
In terms of the 1941 exercises, that's about the...
No, that's right.
Yeah. Okay, so in July 41, according to the battalion history, you moved to Yarmouth.
Yeah, goodbye to Thetford and low grade Yarmouth. Well, that was my first experience as a CQMS of taking over a building. The CQMS's job during the move of the battalion is to go in advance and seek the accommodation. We would know that we'd have to take over certain buildings, which had been previously occupied by soldiers, I suppose, that is speaking. But anyway, Great Yarmouth was my first experience of taking over a building on behalf of my company. And it was a workhouse. When we arrived in Great Yarmouth, we took over the workhouse, which had been hurriedly evacuated only the night before, of all its inmates. My job was to go into the workhouse and note the damages, holes in the wall, broken panes of glass, and things like that that we couldn't be accused of. Otherwise, we would have to pay for repairing, and there's such damage. But anyway, I had to take over certain quarters, and as I took over this vast hall where the inmates the previous night had been hurriedly evacuated. Why were they evacuated? Germans sent over every night to Great Yarmouth, the trainee bombers, and they bombed the hell out of Great Yarmouth night after night without fail. So much so that the civilian population itself, the normal civilian population itself, had been evacuated, but these poor sod devils were in the workhouse. They were moved so quickly that they had to leave their belongings as well, and I, as a CQMS, was entrusted to gather up all that I could see there, some of them were valuable things, and put them all into a little room down the end, making sure that I had trustworthy men as well who had life in them. Because there were watches in some cases left behind and things like that, you know. And we had to remove all these personal possessions into that empty building and lock the door. And that was under lock and key. And that was my first job. Then I had to take over the building itself. It's so doing, when I was getting rid of all these things, I was coming across pollen letters. There was one of them, written by a woman, obviously, to a daughter in Australia, who had replied, "Dear man, whatever is my family doing to allow me to go into the Great Yarmouth workhouse? Who will know this? I'm somewhere across the other end of the world. How can this happen? My heart bleeds for you," and all that sort of thing. And it was so poignant, really speaking, it boiled up to my throat, honestly. And that was in during the war, from an Australian daughter to a mother in a Great Yarmouth workhouse, expressing her sadness to find out that this was where she was. I've never forgotten that. Eventually, of course, noted all the holes in the wall, damages in this doors, things like that, broken glass, all sorts of things, in my list for the quartermaster. And to go to the building. I chose to myself a padded cell in the workhouse because every night silence went, ooh, here he comes again, but nobody made a move at all. We thought, well, if we're going to be hit, we're going to be hit. They dug slip trenches all around the outside of the building, but nobody got up in the middle of the night to go down there. Couldn't be bothered. And I felt so secure in my padded cell, I thought, oh, I'm all right in here. But of course, it was very stupid, it was a small cell, you know, not big enough for, well, for one man, because it was padded for enough of the loonies. But it was a padded cell, the walls were all padded, and I felt as safe as Sabres houses there. And that's my memory of the drama.
And you were still, sorry.
Yeah, apart from the fact that the rest of the town was devoid of civilians, it's gone. Mm-hmm. And the only thing left there were pumps for soldiers and sailors and their servicemen and the odd board, you know. And that was my memory of deserted Gridiron. Smith's factories used to be there as well. Mm-hmm. By that time, when we were there, I think that they were just beginning to sort of evacuate and finish stopping the reduction of Smith's crisps as well. Mm-hmm. Somebody said that is a reason for. The reason for the bombing was just this factory, but I don't think so. It was a convenience for the proper channel to drop the bombs. Mm-hmm.
And you were still at HQ Company at this time, or had you been transferred?
At that time, yes, I was.
And what were the battalion's duties, their general duties?
Well, to be quite frank with you, it was a very short stay. Mm-hmm. It was so short that... I'm not sure whether it was only a matter of a week or two, because, mm-hmm. My memories are mainly of staying there for a very short time and wasn't really taking over this workhouse. We found out that the pubs were just more sort of acquainted and interested with the pubs. Yeah. And we had one out with Bickmore, who was a sergeant.
Who was Bickmore?
Bickmore. He was a sergeant. And he was the first bloke I saw, and he joined the some Hearties in the stores of the ITC, dishing out the uniforms and stamping your identity discs. But by now, he was a sergeant.
Still in the Beds and Hearts?
And he was a professional boxer.
But was he still in the Beds and Hearts?
Beds and Hearts.
Still?
Yes.
So they had a unit station?
He was with us. He came with us to
he was a man who was handing out stores when you were first enlisted.
And now he was one that I'd forgotten about. He was one of the Beds and Hearts, who should have gone to Singapore.
From the depot.
But came to Scotland. Mm-hmm. And he was tattooed all over the place. I've never seen a man so tattooed. And he was so tattooed that when he took his shirt off, he had a big fox. Great guns, the plane was down here, and the fox was down his back with the fox's nose up his bottom. And across his belly here, he had FTA. F the Army. That was Bickmore. Now, it just shows what mentality he had. But he was a professional boxer. And he was a character. He was a leatherneck. If you've seen leathernecks, Marines, and tough guys, Bickmore was the example. Rippling muscles, but he looked, anyway, he said, "Come me down the pub." Jimmy was called Jimmy. So I went down the pub with him into Gage Harbour, but the night before we left the place, we went into this pub full of drunken sailors and everybody, all Army and Air Force, and we were sitting down, two of us, up at the table, having a nice quiet drink. And suddenly this drunken sailor came around, and of all the people he picked on, he was Bickmore. And when Bickmore was drinking his pint, he nudged his arm and he was provoking him. And Bickmore turned down, put his pint down, and turned down, and he says, "F off." And this bloke did. So I knew that Bickmore was a professional boxer. But I didn't expect Bickmore to follow. On the way out of the pub, he had his eye where this bloke was. And he said, "Come on, Jimmy, come with me, we're leaving this place." He walked around the pub and he came to that bloke and he just stood in front of him and he put his fist in front of his chin. It moved by 2 inches, and I heard that crack on his brush chin. Look at another log. I took the cord in and put him in a chair. I walked out. For Christ's sake, if the other rest of the Navy seen that, we could have all the bloody Navy onto us and we couldn't get out fast enough. I've never forgotten that, honestly. Talking about being in bad company, you know, are you for that?
What happened to Big Moore, do you know? And did he go abroad with you?
Because he must have been getting on. He must have been 41 or 40, A1X, over 40. What happened was, I don't know when or how it happened, but nobody told us, but suddenly they weren't on the photograph of Rye. Harry Stern wasn't on the photograph of Rye. Big Moore wasn't on the photograph of Rye. A lot of them wasn't on the photograph of Rye.
And in terms of people like Big Moore, this could be a bad influence on...
No, he was as docile as a lamb. He was as docile, but I knew that he was a professional boxer. Mm. He was an army champion.
Was the battalion, was there like an did they have like inter-sports competitions with the battalion at this time?
No, that was like in the Bedford ITC, when we were there. The greatest delight was, the greatest entertainment was seeing the boxing contests in the ITC with RSM Sharp as the ringmaster. And if you were any good at fighting or boxing, you could volunteer. And you were told by the next, you know, and Big Bull was there in the ring. Oh, that he was. And we had the professional ones, you know, in the ITC. And it was boxing, it was free, you go on, you get along. You weren't allowed to shout, you weren't allowed as a spectator, you were not allowed to cheer, you were not allowed, you had to sit still and quiet. You weren't allowed to be partisan, if you shouted, you'd be thrown out in the gym. Mm.
But in the DLI, there wasn't, you can't remember sports activities at that time,
or at the depots, at the barracks, and at the ITC settings, you see, but not with the battalion on the move outside or in the field, as we were. We were without a roof, really, my battalion, 16th. We were, you know.
Right. So, you weren't at Yarmouth very long. What happened after that?
We went to a place called Worcester Camp. And Worcester Camp, Worcester is a place in North Norfolk. And it was already arranged on the camp. Worcester Camp. Worcester is the name of the place where, incidentally, Norfolk is famous for the weavers of years ago coming to Norfolk and weaving. The Flemish weavers, you know, made cloth. And the Worcester cloth suits. There's no suit better than the Worcester suit from Saddle Row. The best quality. Worcester wool, made in Worcester in Norfolk, and the Worcester camp was there. So it was already in existence. I remember Pickering was there.
So it was still the pre-RSM Thomason time?
Yes, Pickering was there, because I remember particularly that he knew that my father had a shop, and we were talking about my father's horses and about my father's milk floats and whatnot, you see. And he said, has your father got any candle lamps, you know, that they used to put on the old-fashioned carts? And I said, yes, as a matter of fact, I said, you've got about a half a dozen of old lamps lying about in the outhouse. Oh, I wonder if I could have one. He was really pickering. So I wrote to my father to ask him, could I bring one back on my next leave? And he gave me one for Pickering. I spent at a picnic at Bristol Camp. Yeah. Now that Bristol Camp was a fabric canvas. It rained for weeks and weeks and weeks. It rained so much that we couldn't do anything. There was mud everywhere, duckbills everywhere.
And what were the? Where were you? What kind of camp was it that you were in?
Under canvas in gel tents and marquees. And I remember particularly we had a second commander in charge, I forget who his name was, but he was a major. And he wasn't with us very long. And then he came from where he went. But I remember particularly anyway that he ventured into the big marquee, which was the sort of company quartermaster stores, and saw PSM Glover there drinking tea and whatnot. And he says, This reminds me of a bloody territorial Saturday afternoon. PSM Blubber was ordered out and dropped his tea and everything else, and he stopped it, you know. That was a twisted cap, but I don't remember it. I don't know what name that officer was, but he must have been a territorial, I'm going to say that.
According to the battalion history, it was around about this time that the shoulder flashes came in.
Yes.
And you told me off the tape a story about how the leave when you went home to Wales and how proud you were.
Yes, that's right.
Could you just talk about that?
We had a Lieutenant Ponder, or a Captain Ponder, who was in charge of the Regimental Institutes, the PRI. He was the president of the Regimental Institutes, and it was his job. He did all sorts of other things, you know. And I remember him saying, you know, to me, which would you prefer, Coruscant? Shot and shell? Or, that's because your job like this, I said, I'd rather shot and shell, sir. He said, you must be bloody mad, he said, because he was hesitant, he didn't want shot and shell. But anyway, he was Captain Ponder. And everybody, he was sitting sat before me in glasses, and he was a little bit hoity-toity, and everybody's saying, oh, Mr. Ponder. But I'm going to say, I know that I hope that he's still alive, or bless him. But anyway, it was his job to receive the shoulder flashes. But down on that infantry, red lettering on the green, so somebody said, you'll be a shoulder. You look like guardsmen. And they were great. We were issued with one set each to begin with, and we had to sort of carefully sew these onto our shoulder. Parts, you know, so that shoulder flint or shoulder flashes, so that when we walk into that hall, we'd be very proud of the telling down that infantry. I should go home to Wales and down that infantry, down the guardsmen. They all knew, they wouldn't know what the cap badge was, but they knew. They knew what my regiment was with that. But of course, these things didn't last forever, and you got new uniforms as well. When the old ones sort of were faded, but if you got a new uniform, you had one picture flash very carefully with a needle and a pocket knife or something, and tenderly sort of salvage it. Well, I mean, the green part was wool anyway, and you'd make a big hole in there with the needle and thread anyway, but so consequently, you know, you sort of tried to retrieve them and resew it onto a new uniform.
And were they, did they have to come out of the soldier's own pocket, the price of those things?
The initial ones did not, but if you wanted, if they were so worn that you were ashamed to wear them, you could buy a new set for a share.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And off the tape, you said that when you went home, you were singing the marching songs to your brothers and sisters.
That's right. Well, of course, our marching songs, you know, we the DLR, we are some of the boys. We all know our manners, we spend all our tanners. We are respected wherever we go as we march down the avenue. Doors and windows open wide, all the lads and lasses cry, the DLI are passing by, we are some of the boys. Well, of course, my sister was very thrilled with that, and she learned it, you know. And she was working in the Mount Sally Pontypool. She used to sing it to the girls in Pontypool, so everybody sing, all but the DLI, in the Arms Factory in Pontypool.
I should have asked you, Jimmy, earlier, about your brothers and sisters, because there were seven in the family, wasn't there? You were the eldest. So what did your brothers and sisters do during the war? You had one in the arms factory.
One in the arms factory, one became an engineer, guard.
Mm-hmm.
Guard.
Mm-hmm.
That's right, a train guard. On the railway between Cardiff and the top of the valley. Well, I must tell you, their name was Edna. And we were only talking about that recently, because now... Edna was born, I was born in 1919, and Edna was born in 1924. So, she was a teenager, and so she had a job as a train guard. The other sister family was in the arms factory in Pontypool. Anyway, Edna was the guard with a lamp in the flag, and she says, well, the train just started off slow, as you were able to jump in. And the train went without her, left on the platform. They'd all been on the valley without her. Mm. and she never thought to live that down.
And didn't you have a brother in the Air Force, you said, off the time?
I had a brother, yes.
And
I was in Catholic. When I was in Catholic, he joined the RAF. He's 2.5 years younger than me. So he joined the RAF as a mechanic and as an LAC. And he used to get all over the place. He used to be at LAD and he used to service the fighter planes. But he never did one at the LAC. He didn't get a class one. LAC.
Going back to the songs, I mean, can you remember any of the other marching songs that you would sing on the day of
the in the quartermaster stores rule or something.
What does that one go like?
eggs. There were down with eggs in the stores. In the stores. eggs below in the quartermaster's stores. My eyes are dim, I cannot see. I have not brought my specs with me. I have not brought my specs with me. And of course, you count everything as very stores, and there was a dirty rhyme attached to it.
And wasn't there a Sergeant Major song? What was that?
Oh, yes. If you want to know the Sergeant Major, I know where he is. I know where he is. I know where he is. If you want to find the Sergeant Major, I know where he is. I dig behind the shed out the door. I saw him. And so he went on. But anyway, good.
Would these be sung on the march?
Oh, yeah.
And the sergeant, they have to take it in good heart.
Yeah. Oh, yes, that's right. But with the route march, and you had the briskers and aching legs, and you might have done 14 to 15 miles, and the cannon and rifle, which the 8 pound 10 and a half ounces weighed 18 pounds 7 and a half ounces at the end, but my God, it song on the march like that. It was a great relief. You were in the middle of your passport, anyone sang. And that was one of the secrets, I think, of getting through. I mean, the German soldiers loved marching and singing on the march as well.
Were boats part of your responsibility, or would that be, you know, the upkeep of the boats and the issue of the clothes and stuff, I suppose?
Boots?
Yeah.
Oh, yes. Well, absolutely. The boots were most important.
And would they go missing just the same as everything else would?
Well, that's right. And if a chap was missing with his boots, you knew that he had flogged them. That's true. And you really go through, you know, I mean, big post-mortem on that. But, I mean, they were ammunition boots. They were called boots ammunition. And they were heavy boots with hobnails. And they were really heavy. And you had to break them in, you know. But I must say that they were inspected from time to time, but it's all major. And if you saw a man, a little bit down at heel, you'd send to see the carousel, you know. And, but they had, as far as I remember, it's been about a long, long time. And then they were on the news, I can't tell you who it goes, but when you were static in a barracks, I think there was a shoe repairer or a boot repairer. And you'd have your boots tapped, you know, you'd sort of get your boots mended. But at other times, I rather think it was sort of chuck away at the point. But it was farewell and turn.
Yeah. So.